welcome from Toronto, Canada, Fryer.
Perspective in power, exploding out of Canada, the sensational ambassadors of heavy metal. The three-man rock and roll machine is all fired up and moving directly to the top.
The band's an arena rock band, and we're a people's band. I mean, rock, arena rock, rock and roll, heavy metal, whatever you want, however you want to label it. It's people's music. It's not really for fashion-conscious people or people that write for newspapers or, you know.
The music that we play appeals to a certain number of people.
Don't waste my time.
Hello, welcome to Rock and or Roll, and today I'm joined once again by Joe Royland, host of Sit and Spin. Hey, Joe.
Hey, BJ. Thanks for having me back.
It's great to have you back, and we're together today to talk about Triumph.
Triumph? Yes, that's me. Finally, this shitty podcast found an interesting topic to discuss.
Wait, is that Triumph the Insult Comic Dog?
Yes, yes. Thank you for having me. I've never been on a podcast before. I try to only appear on things that people actually watch or listen to. What is this piece of shit show called again?
It's called Rock and or Roll.
Oh, that's an excellent name for me to poop on. But really, it is an honor to be here, I guess.
Actually, Triumph, this is an episode about the band Triumph, the Toronto band.
What? There's a band that stole my name?
Well, actually, they formed in 1975.
Bullshit. In dog years, I had that name first.
Well, but...
So you're telling me I downloaded the Sky P app and installed it on my phone for nothing? You piece of shit, BJ.
I'm sorry for the confusion, but this is a podcast about rock and roll. I'm sure my friend Ken would like to have you as a guest on his podcast, Pop, a Pop Culture Podcast.
You mean Ken Mills? The guy whose laugh sounds like a wet donkey fart? Or maybe sounds that way because his nose is so far up Gene Simmons' ass? I call that show Poop. The Poop Culture Podcast.
Hey, Ken's a great guy and he does a great show, even if his laugh does sound like a wet donkey fart. But Joe and I would like to get started here, so...
Of course, we can't keep the Joe Royland waiting. What did you say his show was called?
Sit and Spin.
Sit and Spin. More like shit and spin. Hey, Joe, why don't you sit and spin on my...
Triumph, please. I'm sorry for the...
Shit and spin.
I'm sorry for the misunderstanding, but this is a podcast about...
Oh, a podcast. Yes, your parents must be so proud. Why don't you yell upstairs and ask them?
Hey!
Hey, Joe, look around. Is your mom's basement bigger than BJ's mom's basement?
Excuse me? Neither of us are in our mom's basement right now.
You're right. I'm sorry. Your stepmother. I kid.
Look, Triumph, once again, I apologize for the confusion, but...
Right. I know you have to get back to telling your listener about the third song on side two of some record no one even cared about when it came out 40 fucking years ago.
Sure, whatever. We're going to get back to recording our episode about the other Canadian power trio now, so once again, I'm sorry, but...
It's okay, I kid. This is an excellent podcast, BJ, after all. It is such an excellent podcast... For me to poop on.
Okay, well...
And speaking of poop, how many people do you think are out there right now listening to this piece of shit show while they take an actual shit? Hey, you, on the toilet, your foot's asleep.
Okay, then. Thanks, Triumph.
Go fuck yourself.
So I've been posting pictures of my record collection a lot on Facebook lately, and you commented on the picture of my 9 Triumph LPs, and you said that we should do a top 10 of Triumph episode, and that's just the kind of random topic that I like to cover on Rock and or Roll. I'm kind of picky about my topics, but something like top 10 Triumph songs, that sounds like fun. So
you said we could call it Triumphs, and I thought that was pretty cool. But because I was like, hey, there's a band we don't hear about all that often anymore. Maybe that'd be a good one to do a top 10 on.
Yeah, Triumph, they you know, I talked on the Led Zeppelin episode about classic rock radio, and this is another band that, holy shit, in Milwaukee at least, it was incessant, but it was about 4 songs just played over and over and over to the point of you kind of hate the songs eventually. I have found that with a lot of those songs that I hated back then, I can go listen to them now and enjoy them because I guess it's been long enough. Triumph were also a band, though, that one of my early influences in terms of getting into music was my friend Dan's dad, and they were a band that he loved, and we used to listen to a lot of his records, and you know, he only had certain things, but he loved Triumph. So in between the radio and Dan's dad, I definitely got into Triumph very early in my music, in my rock music fandom, but you know, didn't hear any of their real early like 70s rock stuff until later. You know, the radio songs were Magic Power, Lay It on the Line, Hold On, and Fight the Good Fight. Those 4 just, you know, incessantly played on Milwaukee classic rock radio, at least, you know, mid to late 80s when I would, you know, that's the era.
Same here, or actually like early 80s more for me. It was like a classic prime high school years, and being that I'm in Maine and we're bordering Canada, we would always get a lot more of a Canadian influence down here. And Triumph were huge here. They would usually come through at least every other album and tour. I saw them once on the Thunder 7 tour. But they were like, all my friends like Triumph. You would always hear the songs on the radio. We would make mixtapes and cruise around listening to them. And they were a big deal here for us then as well.
Yeah, I never saw them live. The first concert I ever went to was in 89. So anything that happened before that, I didn't get to see. But, you know, definitely my friend Dan's dad took us to a lot of my early concerts. He took me to my first concert.
Nice.
So definitely if Triumph had still been around, we would have gone. Like Dan's dad took us to see the Bad Company Damn Yankees double bill. You know, we went to anything like that. So we definitely would have seen Triumph, but they weren't around anymore. Well, at least not with Rick. And I don't know if they must not have even come through the area, you know, on that last album.
I don't know if they did. I don't remember them touring behind you at that album at all.
I'm sure Dan's dad bought it, though.
Yeah.
But, you know, going back and listening to all the Triumph records, they were not a great band in the 70s, in my opinion. They were just kind of an all-right rock band. And the idea that they get lumped in with Rush, it's funny. The only reason is because they're a power trio.
From Canada.
And they're from Canada. Yeah. But there's really, but if you look at other Canadian rock bands, like if you take April Wine or Moxie or whoever, they're just as similar to Rush's Triumph. It's just they have more than 3 guys, so they don't get lumped in with Rush, you know. And also Rick Emmett's voice, he does have a real. It's not as high as Getty's
that's what I was
voice,
gonna say.
But yeah.
But it can get there.
Yeah,
get there. Yeah, to me I mean. Not that you can just say that, but to me it was like they were like a more accessible version of Rush. Like sometimes Rush was like too proggy, too out there. It's like, you know, you couldn't get into that, but Triumph was simple. You could get into, you know, it was easy to get into a Triumph song. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I especially back then, I've come around, but I was not a fan of Rush at all growing up. But because I really only knew Tom Sawyer, whatever. I never bought any Rush records when I was younger, so I didn't like Rush at all, and I liked Triumph a lot. So Triumph were more up my alley, especially the 80s Triumph when they were more of an AOR band. So
And kind of like you were saying, where like some of those songs, even I like there's some of the hits. We're going to get to them when we talk about our list. But there's some of the hits on my list. But a lot of the hits are not on my list because I just got played out on hearing him. And it's kind of like I don't ever want to hear Tom Sawyer by Rush again. I could live the rest of my life and not hear that and I'd be fine.
For sure.
But, you know, yeah. But there's other Rush tunes that I still enjoy. You know, things like Analog Kid or something. You don't hear that on the radio all that often. Like that song.
So. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, growing up, I had no idea how good, like, Caress of Steel was. You know, none of that got played on the radio. So, yeah, you know, like, that's one of their better albums, and there's not a single song on that that was ever on the radio around me. So,
but
that's the horrible thing about classic rock radio is they just take a few songs and play the shit out of them, and even though, you know, why not play more songs by the band than just those three? But that's just how radio works, and I guess that's what the audience wants. I don't know how that could be what they want, but I know when you go when you go to a concert, you see that the crowd, they don't even pay attention until they play the hit song, and then they go fucking nuts.
Yeah,
and I guess that's the physical manifestation of, you know, that radio phenomenon of just play the same song over and over instead of trying out a different song by the same band. But, you know, my favorite was I saw Danzig open for Metallica, and that was right when they decided to play the live version of Mother from that EP on the radio constantly. And so the audience was literally in their seats talking during the Danzig show. And then when Mother started, the entire crowd stood up and went fucking nuts. And then when Mother ended, everybody just sat down and started talking again. And it was just pathetic. But that's how it works with the average person, I guess. They just want to hear that song that they've been trained like Pavlov's dog to enjoy. I don't know.
I know, it's crazy.
But yeah, it's interesting. I looked up Triumph in... I have all the Martin Popoff books, and I thought, okay, Martin Popoff, Canadian. Let's see what he has to say about Triumph. And he's not much of a fan. I was very surprised that he's very negative about most Triumph, especially the 80s. In fact, the last two Rick Emmett records, he gives 0 out of 10 stars.
Wow.
And I looked up, oh, 0. I wonder what he gave Look What the Cat Dragged In. Oh, he gave that 5. So <Jeez. laughs> Look What the Cat Dragged In, he likes way more than, Sport of Kings and Surveillance. So... I was trying to think of what's some of the worst stuff I could look up and see what he gave it. And, I looked up Alice Cooper Trash and he gave that 2 stars. So that made it a little higher. And Winger, he gave 6. So I was like,
what?
Yeah. So Winger is way better than, Surveillance, according to Martin.
Man. And it's funny too. It depends on when he wrote those books too, because your tastes change, like you were saying. Like there were albums that I loved, and then I was just like, oh god, this isn't that good. And then years go by, and then you kind of come and reappreciate him again. So his opinion could have changed too, but who knows?
Well, what I picked up on is he's got it in for Triumph, which maybe so maybe the fact that they're a Canadian band worked against them for him because they're a you know, a Canadian man, he expected more from them, or he has higher standards for them, it almost seems like. And so he really has it in for that album Surveillance for some reason. I like that album a lot. And he really has it in for that record. And I think it's about more than just the music, it seems to me. So
what?
My exposure to Triumph, like I said, was radio and my friend's dad. And then, I remember I had that Classics Best Of that came out in 89. I remember having that on cassette. What did I read? They said that album was just to fulfill the recording contract with MCA.
Right.
So they were like, you know, we wish it had a better cover, but it was just to fulfill the contract. Because it really was just... I think it was just a logo on like a blue background or something.
Well, the interesting thing about Triumph too is like they were one of those bands that would like resync almost all the money they made back into like their show, and they had like a huge stage and probably one of the biggest light shows on the planet. and the productions of their shows. And they owned Metalworks Studios in Canada, which is now just Gil the Drummer is like the sole owner of that. But originally they all had an equal share in it until Gil bought the other two out. And, you know, how many bands can you say have their own recording studio? And that's one of the premier recording studios in Canada. And, you know, so they would do interesting things like that, you know, that not every rock band did. And they were also kind of seen as, like, good guys. See, like, their music had, like, they would get lumped in with metal, even though they weren't really metal. But they were kind of like, oh, these guys are safe to listen to because their songs are positive and they're uplifting. And so they kind of, like, would get a bit of a backlash for that, too. They were, like, too goody-goody. They were the nice Canadian boys, you know?
So all three guys from the band were recently on the Eddie Trunk show, and I thought it was interesting. They were talking on there about how they didn't make a lot of money off the records, and that drives me nuts when I hear that. They sold a lot of records.
Yeah.
In the U.S., I don't know how many, maybe at least like 4 gold albums, and Allied Forces was platinum. And, you know, all those records are platinum in Canada, I think, which in Canada, I think platinum's like 250,000 or something.
Right, but, yeah, it's less.
But you would think they would have made a lot of money just off their record sales alone, let alone touring and everything. But, yeah, like you're saying, that they might not have made a lot of money touring because they sunk so much money into the production because they were pretty famous for their big production at their shows. I think on Eddie Trunk, they were even kind of comparing themselves to Kiss.
Yeah,
and they were kind of talking about how they thought that they were really influential in the direction that arena rock went, you know, into the late 70s, early 80s. They kind of feel like they were one of the first, like, real arena rock bands, you know, arena rock in quotes, I guess. And that's probably sort of true. They definitely, like we're saying, they weren't like Rush because they have much more of that kind of, you know, more simple rock and roll, working man rock and roll sound.
Yeah.
You know, they're just, I mean, they were tailor-made for classic rock radio. That's why classic rock radio loved them so much.
Well, they were saying, too, that, like, they look to Rush as, like, an example. Like Rush kind of, like, as I think Mike Levine put it, they opened the door enough so that they could get through, and then they would kind of look at Rush and say, okay, what did Rush do? Okay, well, let's do this. You know, they make no bones about the fact that, you know, Rush was sort of an influence to them, but they kind of like looked at them like, well, they're doing that. Let's do this. You know, if Rush is going to be really cerebral, let's be a little bit more simple. Let's make things a little bit more accessible to getting through to them. And when you were talking about the show thing too, they very much believe they came from that generation. They're like, when they were younger and seeing a band like Kiss, and like, to them, it was like, if you're going to have people come and see you play, you need to put on some kind of show. You need to entertain them. It can't be just the music. You need to make it worth their while to come and see you so that they remember you. It's like people may have not have heard of you before they went to see you, but then they went to see you and they're going to be talking about the show afterward. They're going to be like, man, there were lasers and there was all this stuff. So it was enough to them to be remembered for the spectacle as it was the music.
Like you were talking about Rush opening the doors for them. Yeah, basically, Rush were successful, and then here comes another band with three guys from Canada, from Toronto. Yeah, they could just kind of be like, oh, well, you know, we just had Rush here. Let's have these guys, too. So that helped a lot with their touring and getting booked and, yeah, just, like, building their career. It did help that they had, like, some Rush connections, even though, like I said, if there would have been four guys in Triumph, I don't think there would have been any Rush connection any more than April Wine or whatever. So, but yeah, they did kind of take advantage of that to a certain extent. And but it must also really frustrate them at some point to be constantly grouped with Rush as if they're like baby Rush or, you know, Rush's kid brother.
Yeah. Poor man's Rush was like the one I used to read a lot.
Yeah. So do you have anything else to talk about just like in terms of Triumph's career? I was going to say that the record company must really, the record industry must really lament how they could put out something like Triumph Classics and sell 500,000 copies of it. Like, I remember when I did my Foreigner episode and I saw that Records, which was Foreigner's like best of thing, that sold millions of copies, like 2 or 3 million. And I looked it up and that came out, like all the songs on that were like 5 years or less old. And the record companies were able to just repackage the same songs 5 years later and sell millions of them again.
Yeah.
And so nowadays, when they look back, that they were able to sell millions of copies of the best of Foreigner 5 years after the first album came out, you know, they must really be like, wow, those were the days. And, you know, even Triumph's best little, you know, rush job contract fulfillment 10 song best of went gold. You know, it's crazy to think about.
Well, that was kind of... Actually, I'm going to jump back to your last point for a minute. One of the other things I'd read, too, was that maybe one of the reasons why they didn't make a lot of money off the records, too, because they were saying that they were constantly overspending their budget on recording records and stuff, and that would often get them into trouble with the labels. Because like, in Canada, they were signed to Attic Records, and then they signed the deal with RCA in the U.S., which was pretty much from... Just a Game through Never Surrender, but things kind of started souring after Never Surrender came out, and then that's when they signed the deal with MCA Records, because Irving Azoff kind of came in and said, hey, I like you guys, I want you on my label, and he kind of like bought them out of their debt through RCA, and then part of the deal with that was that MCA would acquire the rights to all their back catalog for 10 years. And now the band owns their back catalog now. They actually purchased it back from MCA. Probably got it for a song now. but I think that was one of maybe they may have incurred a lot of debt just from jumping around through record labels too. That, so that's probably why they didn't make as much money off them. And now it's like, you know, they don't really have like the following they did back then. So maybe somebody buys a Triumph record every now and again, but it's certainly not in like the numbers they used to back in the 80s.
It's the same old story. They had like what, 3 gold records, and yet they're still in debt. So they had the falling out with RCA, which probably was over that kind of thing. They're probably like, you know, shouldn't we be getting checks by now? You know, we're selling.
Right.
We've sold millions of records now. Maybe we should be seeing some of that money. Yeah. So yeah, I mean the record industry got away with murder back then.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're gonna count down our top 10 personal favorite Triumph songs. Now, like I've made the distinction before, these are my favorite songs. I'm not saying they're the best Triumph songs. Like they're not the best musically. They're not the whatever best means. I think that's different from favorite. I'm just talking about the ones that are my favorites to listen to that I like the most, based on my taste. So,
like, these are the ones that, like, do something for me personally. I'm sure we were talking about this before. I'm sure there's going to be some Triumph fans that aren't going to agree with some of our picks. But that's fine. You know, they have their favorites. These are ours. And actually, like, I had a kind of a hard time narrowing things down to 10. There were other songs that was like, oh, I want to use this one, but I only have room for 10 tracks. And so there's a couple of albums where maybe I only picked one song from that record. Doesn't mean I didn't like the rest of the album. It just meant that there were more good songs on another album, and I felt like, oh, I have to have this. And even whittling them down, it was hard. So you'll see when we get through them.
Yeah, narrowing it down wasn't as hard for me. I still have, you know, a certain group of Triumph songs that I still listen to. But what I kept flipping around was the order. the ranking the songs, like this one's better than that one, which is fun for me to do, but I probably also, you know, shouldn't be as meticulous about it.
I shifted around a lot
over
the last week of putting this together.
Yeah.
And I'm still not happy with it, but it is what it is right now.
Well, then I caught myself being like, well, I don't want to have 2 songs from the same album in a row, and then I'm like, wait, you know, you just gotta try to put them in the order of how you think they're best. And if there's 2 from the same album in a row, then get over it.
I was doing the same thing, and I just said, screw it.
Yeah. So do you want to start with your 10th favorite Triumph song?
Okay. this is something we were talking about before we got this going too. And like, to me, this might seem like a really controversial opening pick, but this is a song that it's a ballad. It's off the Sport of Kings album. The song's called Just One Night with Gil Moore on lead vocals. I like this song. The interesting thing is that this tune isn't written by the guys in the band. It was written by Eric Martin from Mr. Big, Neil Sean from Journey, and Tony Finucci. And it originally appeared on Eric Martin's 1985 self-titled album. And I just think it's a great album. I think the song is really suited to Gilmore's voice. I think he sings the shit out of it.
I have that Eric Martin album, but I haven't listened to it much. I should have gone and listened to his version. I don't remember. Do you like his version more, or do you like the...
I like his version, but I just feel it. To me, it seems like a demo compared to the Tryon version.
Yeah.
And I mean, and I will say that Rick Emmett pretty much almost copied the solo. Is not that different from the way Neil Schon played it. It's pretty similar. You know, he didn't change it too much, but when I play him side by side, the Eric Martin, and I'm a big Eric Martin fan, but it feels like a demo to me. The pacing's a little different, and it just doesn't seem as good to me. It's still a good song, but just not as good as Tryon.
My number 10 is the only song from the 70s that made it on my list, and just barely, because those early Triumph albums are just really kind of mediocre 70s rock. Nothing special about it, really. But this is the first song, well, at least it's the first song in the American version of the second album, Rock and Roll Machine, called Takes Time. There was just so many similar bands from that era with much better songs than Triumph, I guess, is why their 70s stuff just doesn't stand out. But this is just a good kind of aggressive 70s rocker, you know, one of the heavy songs that Gil sang. I like the chorus. It's got a good hook. There was, you know, there were probably three or four songs that were kind of competing for this number 10 spot that I had to decide, but yeah, so Takes Time from Rock and Roll Machine. The only song from the 70s that made the cut.
Yeah, I feel the same way about that 70s stuff. It almost sounds like a different band, you know, some of the production text. It definitely sounds like the 70s as opposed to once they get into the 80s, they almost sound completely different as far as terms of production, songwriting, arrangement. That type of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
It's very different.
Yeah.
So I did, there's nothing from the first two albums on my list.
Right.
All right. My number nine is also, I guess, could be considered somewhat of a controversial pick because those last two albums with Rick a lot of times don't get a lot of credit. So this is one from Surveillance, again, Gilmore singing. And again, a song that features outside writers. It's the final song on the Surveillance album, a song called Running in the Night. I just like the song. Something about the song does something for me. I'm surprised it was actually the last track on the album. I think it probably would have done better if it was a different place in the run order. I think it seems kind of out of place being the last song on the record. But the song has the two outside writers were Mark Baker and Eric Scott, who would actually later bring the song to their own band. Right. And the debut album was called Loud and Clear. But on their album, the song is called Go. And the difference is that there's different lyrics on the Triumph version. The guys from Triumph get a co-writing credit because it's a slightly different arrangement. There's different lyrics to it. And I think one of the reasons they changed the name of the song to Go on the Signal album is because there is also a song on that album called Run Into the Night. So it gets extra confusing. As, like, I remember when I went to first listen to their version on that album, I went to listen to the song, and I'm like, this doesn't even sound anything like it. And then I realized, oh, it's not that tune, this song.
That's hilarious.
So it's kind of confusing. I like the Triumph version of the song better. Again, it's got too many keyboards. The only other negative I would say about it is just that just as the guitar playing starts to cook near the end of the song, that's when the song fades out. But I like that tune. It's actually the only song from Surveillance that made it onto my list. There are some others I like. I just didn't have enough space.
Yeah, that's a good one. I actually love Surveillance, which I've loved it since it was new. Always really liked that album. And in fact, my number nine song is from Surveillance, but it's called On and On, which...
Oh, that was one of my runner-ups, yeah.
Yes, people who listen regularly to the show know my taste, especially the AOR, AOK episodes. I love that kind of music. Surveillance is AOR.
Oh, yeah.
Really. What I love is 80s hard rock or metal that has pop leanings, you know, big choruses.
Yep.
Calling up lady luck, she just lets you down. And so they don't look back on it fondly. Like, you can tell that that especially Rick Emmett doesn't like those last couple albums. And they talk a lot about record company interference, which...
Oh, yeah, there was a lot.
Yeah. So they were, you know, I don't know how much of surveillance was them trying to please the record company, or I don't know what all the motivations were.
I know some of them. I know, like, some of the things on that album is, like, where Rick was, like, he's talking about he had issues with him is because he wanted to kind of step outside of the Triumph box a little bit more. He was saying that was one of the things that kind of made him leave the band. He just felt it got too limiting. He said, like, Gil and Levine's like, no, a Triumph song's got to kind of fit into this mold. But part of it, you know, he wanted to do other stuff. I think Surveillance is like the one album where you actually get to see the beginnings of that. Like, I think he stretches out more on that album than he does on any Triumph album. But they're definitely, you know, that was one of those records where, and I should actually go back somewhat to this. Like, Sport of Kings was like the first record where there was a lot of label interference.
Yeah.
And like when they signed with MCA, MCA's like, okay, like, we have one stipulation, is that at some point we want you to work with a name producer, and that name producer is going to be Ron Nevis. And there's like, okay, you know, we'll do that. And when Thunder 7 came out and was had hits, and but it wasn't as big a seller as they'd hoped it would be, they're like, we definitely want you to work with this outside producer. So they go to work, starting to work on the Sport of Kings album with Ron Nevis. And the idea is like, okay, you know, I'm going to bring in some outside writers because we want to have hits, you know, and I've got these exclusive songs. And during the pre-production, they got along fine. But then once it came time to actually do the recording, according to the band, Nevison kind of became, okay, it's my way or the highway. We're doing stuff this way or we're not doing it at all. And he says, Ron Nevison says, when he went into the production of the album, he went into it under the thinking of, we're going to make this record, I'm going to use outside writers, and there's only going to be one singer on the album, and it's not going to be the drummer. And I think once, you know, they started to clash on things like that, because, you know, like, Gil Moore wasn't going to have that. He's like, no, there's two singers in this band. So once it became clear that they were just couldn't agree on things, Ron Nevison said, I'm out. And he left halfway through the making of the record. And basically his assistant was this guy named Mike Klink.
Yep.
And even when they went in to kind of do the record, it was kind of like Nevison's like, okay, I'm going to get the beds laid down, and then I'm going to go off and I have to work on this other record, and then I'm going to come in and oversee final mixing. So Klink was his engineer, and basically now he's stuck with the task of finishing the album. And at this point, you know, he's pretty much only known as an engineer. He doesn't have any producer credits. And they get the record done, and it comes out sounding great. I mean, it's a great sounding album. There's a lot of good songs on it, but it gets this backlash of being too commercial. It almost worked against them. Like the idea that the record company had in mind actually ended up working against the album. And, you know, the record doesn't sell. And interestingly enough, the next project Mike Klink would have would be Guns N' Roses, Appetite for Destruction, which is about as far away from the Sport of Kings and sound as you know, styles and ideals as you can get. You know, Appetite for Destruction is sometimes credited with also, like, bringing realness back to, like, hard rock and heavy metal instead of, like, all the glam metal that have been out there. So that's kind of an interesting paradigm. But when Surveillance came around, the band really wanted to work with Mike Klink again, but they couldn't because he's busy doing Guns N' Roses. So one of the label execs, a guy named Tom Trumbo, had to kind of come in and oversee production on the record. And there, that's the end of that story. Long story, but there you go.
Yeah, I knew that Ron Nevison quit, like, during the making of the record, but I didn't know the whole story. Like, that he wanted only Rick to sing? That's pretty messed up.
Well, I think in his thinking, and this is something that we kind of talked about a little bit before we were doing this, is that when you have a band like Triumph and they have two singers, in some ways that helps you, in some ways that hurts you, because there's no one unified voice to the band. It's like people hear a song and they're like, who is this again? Because they've heard the hits by the one guy, but they haven't heard the other guy, and they kind of don't realize it's the same band. It could be a good thing, can see it as a good thing, or a bad thing. Like, if you're like the Beatles or Kiss, having four different, or the Eagles, you know, like having three or four singers may not matter, but, you know, and sometimes in a smaller band, maybe it makes a difference between how successful you are or you aren't.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. But as for On and On from Surveillance, it's a, I would admit it's a pretty generic song, but it's the exact kind of song I like, but it's also probably, it's the exact kind of song that a lot of fans of early Triumph don't like and would call like a sellout or whatever. Yeah. But that's, so I think I'm more of a fan of this kind of a song than I am of Triumph. But what I really love is Triumph doing this kind of song. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
I love that kind of thing. So I'm all for it. I you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And there's a lot of that on both of those albums, on Surveillance and Sport of Kings. Like, going back and listening to Sport of Kings, I was, like, really surprised. Like, that album just gets dogged so much. But there's just some good songs on that. They might not be what would be considered Triumph songs, but that doesn't mean that they're not good songs. Or you have a song like Into the Fire. I think it is it's almost an Iron Maiden song in the style. But, you know, it's different. But, like, kind of like, I see where you're coming from, where it's like, if you just heard the song and you didn't know it was Triumph, you would still think it was a good song.
Yeah.
But then you have to kind of, then you're judging it on like, oh, but it's Triumph doing the song, so I shouldn't like this because this doesn't sound like them. Well, what does that matter? If it's a good song, it's a good song. It shouldn't matter who's doing it.
And in my opinion, they were way better when they were doing a song like this than when they were doing just that, whatever, boogie rock, whatever they were trying to do early on. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so number 8.
For me, would be a song that's sort of, I guess, a forgotten fave. It's a song, Mind Games. It's one of two studio tracks that the band did for their live album, Stages. Again, I got another song with Gil singing lead vocals. He doesn't play drums on it, though. Drums were played by Max Webster's Gary McCracken, as Gil Moore had injured his arm prior to the recording. But it's the kind of song, to me, that maybe would have helped make fans of Sport of Kings, or helped make fans of Triumph like Sport of Kings more. Like, if Mind Games had ended up on Sport of Kings, it probably would have helped that record in most Triumph fans' opinions. But it's just a good, straightforward rocker. The intro music kind of reminds me of Thin Lizzy when the guitars first kick in, so I also like that as well. But it's like one of those songs you kind of forget about because it's a studio song on a live album.
Yeah, that song's all right. I wonder if, with songs like that, I always wonder if they wrote it brand new for the live album, or if it's a song they already had that like didn't make the record and then they just record it for the live album.
Lying Around or something.
Yeah, right.
But I just dig it. Like, when I was going back through the stuff, I'm like, oh yeah, that song. I like that song, you know. So
yeah, I love something like that. Putting two new studio tracks on the live record, that was an awesome kind of thing the band did.
So what's your number eight?
My number eight is once again from Surveillance. You already mentioned this song, Headed for Nowhere. I have always loved that. It's upbeat, almost like metal song, really.
Yeah.
Sung by Gil, and same as I said about On and On, it's kind of a generic song, but it's got a great melody. For me, upbeat and melodic, that's my favorite kind of thing. And then also pretty much my favorite thing is 80s hard rock and metal. So it's all here. This is just Triumph doing like pretty much an 80s metal song.
My number seven is the only 70s song at the end of the 70s. It comes off the Just a Game album. One of the hits, actually one of the first hits for the band in the U.S. and one of the tunes that broke them here, which is Lay It on the Line. It kind of set up a bit of a formula, especially in Rick Emmett's songs on their following albums, where you'd have like the loud, quiet, loud passages. And pretty much every record they did after this would have a song like this on it, and this was like the first one. But it's a good tune. Not totally played out on that one yet. It's just kind of tune. If it comes on the radio, I'm like, oh, cool, I'm gonna turn that up. But I had to have at least something off that album on my list, so that was the one that made it.
Yeah, nothing from that album made my list. That I would love to experience how I would feel about that song if I heard it for the first time, you know, because there's just no way to even, I hear that song way too many times. I think it's too slow for me to put it in my top 10, you know. It's not a bad song, but I think it's just a little too plodding and just not enough energy.
Well, it's a formula I think that they improved upon with each successive record, but it, like, to me, that's where it begins. Well, there's some of the older albums have songs that are sort of in that thing, but to me, that's the one that it kind of begins at this tune. And like I remember when it first came out, hearing it on the radio, going, "Oh, who's this?" You know, and that album in general. I didn't have it at first. My older brother actually got it before me. But what's interesting about that, I didn't put this song on my list, but the title track from that album, you can fade out. I used to do this. You can segue that right after Take Me Away Together is One by Paul Stanley. It's almost the same exact riff. Like the way that song fades out and the way that song fades in, you can put them, segue them right together and they work perfectly. So it's like,
yeah, Lay It on the Line is definitely an interesting. Not a lot of stuff sounded like it at the time. I don't think it's so. It must have stood out, and I think it's really. Yeah, you know, that's when they shifted away from their kind of boring early sound, and you know, started branching out and doing different things, and that's when they kind of made a name for themselves. So
right, and there was Mike Levine produced the album, and there was a marked difference in production between the earlier album. I think that was actually the first album they did at Metalworks. So I think that was like when they got Metalworks and had the new studio, that made a huge difference in sound. Yeah, it actually was their first album that they did with Metalworks Studio. So you can hear it.
Yeah, but speaking of that, my next song, my number 7, I think the production is kind of bad on it, but it's a great song. It's the title track from their 1981 album Allied Forces. And I wrote down that even though this record came out in 1981, this song sounds very much like the 70s to me. But the production, I guess it's mainly the drums kind of sound like shit on the song.
Yeah.
So I was thinking I would play the version from the US Festival recording, because I think it's a much better sounding version of the song. But this is an awesome song. It's great.
I'd like to see some hands in the air. I want to see some Allied Forces out there making a little bit of noise. You know what I'm talking about?
I love that tune. But let's see. So my number 6 also comes from the Allied Forces album. And speaking of that formula, it would be the song from that album that fits the same formula as Laying on the Line, which is Fight the Good Fight. Again, another one of the band's hits. But I think it comes together better on Fight the Good Fight than Laying on the Line. Actually, some of the chord progressions are very similar, especially in the rockin' parts. But there's a lot of cool things musically going on in the arrangement. There's like from the clean and crunchy guitars, there's a 12-string acoustic, even the synths, the way they're coming it out, the bass and the drum work is pretty tasty. Good guitar solo too. And I think bands like Zebra, as much as they owe like some of their sound to Zeppelin, I don't think they would have existed without a song like Fight the Good Fight being a template for them. I totally hear a lot of that in that band as well. Finally getting some Rick Emmett songs on my list.
Yeah. Feels like we're running out of time. So my number 6 comes off the Thunder 7 album from 1984. Now, I understand it was their 7th album, but what the hell does Thunder 7 mean? Is that a play on words or something?
It's a Native, they list it someplace, but it's a Native American thing, or First Nations, as they would say in Canada.
Uh-huh.
But it's Man is the Seventh Thunder or something. I can't remember. It's been a while, but it has something to do with, like, I think Native American lore.
Did I even say the name of the song yet? It's Spellbound, which is just a great 80s hard rock riffy song with a catchy chorus. And, you know, you were saying that they weren't really a metal band, but I was listening, when I was just listening to this song, I was listening to it and I was like, this sounds exactly like a Great White song. In fact, Gil sounds exactly like Jack Russell on the song. And you could take this song and put it on like Shot in the Dark and it would sound exactly like it belonged on the record. But yeah, it's funny that Great White are considered a heavy metal band, at least from my point of view, and Triumph aren't. Because what really was that heavy metal about Great White either? But it was just, I guess it was more about the image and the, I don't know what it was about, but yeah, I mean, you know, the term heavy metal is so convoluted now that people saying Great White weren't heavy metal. Well, we thought of them as heavy metal then, you know?
Yeah. And they kind of got lumped into the whole hair metal, glam metal scene too, because a lot of bands that weren't did just because they had poofed up hair. You know, it's like, doesn't necessarily mean you're the same type of music, but
and then this, a lot of bands like Triumph tried to sound like those other bands, you know, as they moved right. into the 80s.
Because that's what was selling.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah. So yeah, I like Spelldown too. That was another almost made, but didn't quite make, but just because it was kind of like a great tune, but I just like kind of got played out on it, but still a good song.
Yeah, and there's an awesome version of it on stages too.
Yeah, so. Yeah. My number five pick, it is the song When the Lights Go Down from Never Surrender Again, sung by Gil. It's not just your typical song about getting your rock on, although that's pretty much what the lyrics are about. There's that cool acoustic slide intro that kicks into that killer riff. It's bluesy, but not straight, 12-bar bluesy. I think Tesla, it would be a band, we did our top 10 on them, that would emulate this formula.
My number five is the first song on The Sport of Kings, Tears in the Rain, from 1986. Like I keep saying, it's kind of a generic song. It's not, but it's a cool song. It's got a great chorus. I don't know. I think this was the first song on Classics, too, if I remember. We'll be right back.
I guess that brings us to my number four, the title track from Never Surrender, lead vocal by Rick. Again, it's that you know, same epic in the style of Fight the Good Fight, Lay It on the Line, similar theme lyrics, positive update thing. But I think musically that tune has a whole lot more going on for it than either Lay It on the Line or Fight the Good Fight. Got like Rick Emmett is essentially playing reggae guitar chords in a hard rock setting, which is kind of nice. I like that album a lot, actually, but that tune probably more than any of the others on that record just still does something for me.
Well, you said reggae guitar, but it's really similar to the Fight the Good Fight. Guitar, you know, there's the verse guitar in Fight the Good Fight. Isn't it similar to that?
It's similar, but like the chord structure he's playing, like it's almost a reggae chord. And the way he's playing it, it's like, that's interesting. You know, hearing that in a hard rock metal-y kind of song, that's the context is it was an interesting choice. You know my commitment.
Well, my number four song, this one this is one that I moved up in the list as I was listening to the songs and trying to put the order in, and this one kept moving up because I really love it, and it's another song from Surveillance. This is my third song from Surveillance, the last album with Rick Emmett, and it's called Never Say Never.
Keep out of faith is a
And this one, like I was saying, that Spellbound sounds like Great White. When I was listening to this, I was thinking it sounds a lot like a Dokken song.
Yeah.
But so
that, yeah, especially the guitar chords.
Yeah.
Very George
Lynch. It's very, yeah. It sounds very Dokken. And the melody too, I think. But
yeah.
It's just a great AOR or like 80s pop metal song, which I love the shit out of that kind of music. So yeah. And it would be perfect like on an 80s movie soundtrack. It's just, which of course I love, you know, hard rock from 80s movie soundtracks, all that kind of thing. I just, somebody asked me, I think somebody emailed me and said I should do an episode about the first songs that I think like influence where, because I don't really know how your taste in music develops or where it comes from.
Yeah.
But when they asked me, like, what do I remember are the first songs? And for me, it was songs from movies. That was the first, because yeah. I didn't, like, before I had albums, my parents didn't listen to music, so I wasn't influenced by them. I think the very first songs that caught my attention were in movies, and it was the song Megaforce.
Yep, 707.
Yeah, and the song that I played on like the first AOR AOK episode by John Fiore from The Heavenly Kid called Out on the Edge.
Yeah.
It was songs like that from movies. The songs from Terminator. Those were what caught my attention, and I really think that in part shaped my taste in music so that I love songs like that.
My number three, you already picked it, is one of yours, Allied Forces, from the title track of the Allied Forces album,
right.
Sung by Gil. I think it's one of the all-time great title tracks of a record. Just a killer driving rocker built on that repeating riff that just, you know, it just explodes out of the grooves. Probably one of the heavier songs the band ever did. Yeah, the production is, I would agree with you, it's kind of a little muddy on parts, but... I love that song, and Gil's scream at the 3:15 mark is one of the best, if not most underrated screams in rock and roll history. It's just killer. But that's my number three, is the title track from Allied Forces.
Well, my number three is one that you already mentioned, Fight the Good Fight, which is probably the only one of those radio songs that I can still listen to. But, I mean, it's such an impressive song. And all three guys, on Eddie Trunk, somebody called in and asked them if they had to pick one song that, like, represented triumph. All three guys said Fight the Good Fight would be their pick.
Spirit, keep up your
So I guess that brings me to my number two song. And again, this was one of the ones that kind of went up and down in the top three. I couldn't decide where I was going to put it, but it ended up at number two. It's the only song I picked off of Thunder 7. It's the song Killing Time. And the lead vocals are shared by Rick and Gil, which is one of the things I really like about it. I don't think you'd ever really heard them trade vocals in a song before, except for they would do it on Follow Your Heart, also from this record. But something about this song, I love the melody tempo changes in it, but there's just something about this song that just does it for me. There's a line that Gil has where the lyric is like, all the times you turned on me, and the way he delivers it, the emotion he delivers it with.
So my number two is probably going to be surprising, But I just love this song, Somebody's Out There, from The Sport of Kings. It was their big try at a hit. It was their, like, pop single. I did read that the record company were asking them for a single, and they wrote this just as the single. But
yeah,
they did a hell of a job. Yeah.
Yeah.
They did a hell of a job, because I think it's a wonderful song. I like the production. The melodies of the song are so great. It's cheesy and it's poppy, but give me more. I think it's awesome.
Yeah.
I've always loved the song. I can listen to this song anytime and enjoy the hell out of it. It's an 80s pop single by a hard rock band, which I love that kind of thing. So,
and it was their biggest hit.
Yeah, but it was only like number 27 or something. So
that's still their highest charting song.
Yeah, I remember it being on MTV quite a bit at the time. It's an obvious attempt at a pop single. But for me, if you say the guys in Triumph are going to sit down, because they wrote this all themselves, no outside songwriter on the song.
Right.
So if you say the guys in Triumph are going to sit down and they're going to try to write a pop single, my reaction is awesome. You know, that's my reaction. So, and they did such a great job. Everything about the song, I think, is great. I think it's very well written, and just, it's a great melody. So I just love the song, but people probably hate it. So I don't know.
I don't hate it, but it's just like one of those ones where I probably heard it too many times, but I agree. It's a great pop song. So
yeah, I think
you can't fault it for that.
It's the kind of song for me, I couldn't really hear it too many times. You know, there's certain songs I'll never be sick of. You know, I can always, I'll just always enjoy it.
So
You could probably almost say the same sort of thing about my number one pick, which is that it's kind of a pop song, especially for the album that it's on and for the time that it came out and for the type of music Triumph was doing. And that's the song Say Goodbye off of Allied Forces. I've always loved this tune. It used to get quite a bit of radio airplay up here. It's a great kiss off song. Got some really nice slide guitar playing throughout the song. Almost an old school, I think where the pop element comes in is kind of like the harmony vocals. It's almost like Everly Brothers style harmony vocals, and that little vocal bridge part is terrific. It's kind of surprising to me that it was like the last song on Allied Forces. It kind of seems to me, again, I would have placed it differently in the running order, but I don't know what it is about this tune. I've always liked it. It's always what I've considered probably my favorite Triumph song. And it's maybe a little different from the stuff that they were doing at that time or even their other stuff in general. Like, I think it's more poppy for them, but I love this tune, you know. So that's my number one, is Say Goodbye.
Getting way out of line, I wanna tell you, you're acting too damn smart.
Well, my number one, I've already played it on the show. I think I played it on the first AOR AOK episode. I just love it so much. Follow Your Heart from Thunder 7. Which we didn't, again, I don't think we mentioned that album was co-produced by Eddie Kramer.
Eddie Kramer, yeah.
Yeah, and great riffs on the song, and the melody is so great. The chorus, big chorus, you know, kind of like a fist-pumping type chorus. Yeah. So it's exactly what I love. It's a heavy rock song from the 80s with a great melody and a big chorus. And like you said earlier, Rick and Gil trading off on the chorus is awesome. It's pretty simple production, which I guess was Eddie Kramer's style, but it really works. You know, I don't think this song has any synthesizers. Like Spellbound kind of has an obtrusive synthesizer in it, but I don't think Follow Your Heart does.
I don't think it does either.
It's just got a great guitar sound and an awesome melody. So I love this song. It's definitely my favorite Triumph song. I didn't have to give much thought to know which one was my favorite. So
that's another one that was in my runners up. It was like, damn, I just don't have enough room to put all these songs on here. So it would just keep, like, I would keep reshuffling the list, and it's like, oh, didn't make it. So, but yeah, it is a good scene.
It's funny with this list. I knew what the top two were going to be, like, immediately. I knew which were my two favorite Triumph songs, like the ones that I'll listen to more than any others. So it was just kind of getting the order of the other eight. But I knew what the top two were going to be, like, right from the start, because I love them. So. Yeah, so I thought I liked the idea of doing a Triumph episode because it's kind of random. And also, I knew I had a different take on Triumph because I knew my favorite Triumph music was not probably the average person's favorite Triumph music. And then I could highlight, like, I love those songs off Surveillance. I've always loved those songs from Surveillance.
Yeah.
Which probably most people haven't even heard ever, I would think.
Well, same thing, like Surveillance and even Sport of Kings. Like, I love both those records, even though, like, only one song from each record made my list. But I love listening to both those albums.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything wrong with either of them.
No. Yeah, I guess they just got painted into a corner with the record label and just the way the what was popular was shifting and changing. And, you know, they, I mean, there's always the dynamics of, well, we got to make a living. You know, you can make the kind of record you want to make, but you also got to think about selling records, keeping your record contract, making a living, fans coming out to the shows. There's so much that goes into that went into it besides just making whatever record you wanted to make. So,
well, that's the thing. It's hard to say too, because they were pretty consistent about making an album almost every year, but it seems like maybe, and these are all the kind of things you can go back and say, maybe it was this, maybe it was that, but maybe putting out a double live album in 1985 wasn't the right choice to keep their momentum going.
Right.
You know, maybe they should have just put Thunder 7 out then, and maybe things would have continued on. And like you said, the shift music changed so much in that quarter of 86-87 for what was hot and what wasn't. And, you know, here we were talking about how, like, they really wanted to work with Mike Clink again, and Mike Clink works on what essentially is like the biggest album of 1987, you know, and instead of, and their album is like, you put Surveillance up to Appetite Destruction in terms of popularity and what was happening in music, and they're just like opposite ends of the spectrum almost. Doesn't mean that Surveillance isn't a great album. It's just very different from what was happening on Appetite for Destruction in terms of like what the populace was into at that time.
Yeah.
So they just found themselves very out of place. Like, I remember, like, I bought Surveillance the day it came out. I was all excited to get it, and I liked it a lot, and I didn't get why don't people like this record? So.
And then when they replace Rick and they come out with an album, which pretty much they were trying to be a hair metal, make a hair metal album, but yeah, that doesn't even come out until 93, and by then it's too late.
Yeah, hair metal's too.
They missed it all, so.
It's like, I remember when that album came out, I think I had a copy of it, and I think I listened to it like once and went, yeah, this isn't too bad. And then it sat on the shelf for years, and it was years again before, like maybe even 6 or 7 or longer years until I actually dug it out and listened to it again. And when I did, I'm like, you know, this isn't a half bad record. It doesn't sound like I didn't pick anything off of it, because I kind of don't consider it a Triumph album, right, even though 2/3 of the band are on it. It just doesn't feel really like a Triumph album. And even the band, when they got their catalog back, and granted it was on a different label, but that was like the one record that didn't redo, and because they remastered and reissued all their albums, that was the only one they didn't do, was that album. And I was actually just listening to it again the other day, and in some of the songs, Gil Moore almost sounds like Sebastian Bach, like the vocals. I was like, wow, that doesn't sound like Gil Moore, but that's who he reminded me of when I was listening to it. And there's some good songs on it. It's a decent listen, but it doesn't feel like a Triumph album to me.
Yeah, it really isn't. And they were obviously trying to make, and then they were too late by the time they got it out to. And just the idea that Triumph are going to, you know, sell albums to like the Warrant and Slaughter people just because they kind of changed their sound a little bit is kind of really misguided too. But,
right.
And yeah, I mean, Rick Emmett bailed, you know, he, as the ship was sinking, he you know, he jumped out. I mean, pretty much. I mean, I guess they were going in a direction he didn't really like, but also, you know, they were obviously their career was on a downward trajectory at that point anyways. If I'm gonna start listing my favorite bands, it's gonna take me a long time to get around to Triumph. They're definitely not one of my favorites, but they were one of the earliest bands I probably listened to a lot, and I do have a great fondness for some of their songs, so I thought it was an interesting topic to cover.
Yeah, they're like, I would agree, like, they're one of those bands that, would I list them, would they make like the top 50 of my favorite bands? Maybe not, but if you said, are you a Triumph fan? I'd say, oh yeah, you know, and yeah. Do I own all their albums? Yeah, I do. Yeah, so, yeah. And every now and then, maybe once every couple of years, I go out and I get on a little kick and I spend a week or so listening to the catalog, and then it's on to the next thing.
Yeah, well, thanks for doing this with me. I'm glad
thanks for having me back.
And yeah.
Hey, Halifax, how you doing? Are you having a good time so far? Okay, we have reached that portion of the program where the other guys go and have a beer and they send me out here all by my lonesome. I'd like to play a piece for you from the Thunder 7 album. This is called Midsummer's Daydream.
This is Triumph the Insult Comic Dog. I do like the Rock and Roll podcast. I like the No Shame episode BJ does. Kind of like when I hump his mom. She has no shame. But she is good to keep around. For me to poop on.
Be back.
It smells so bad in this basement. I haven't smelt anything this bad since I was underneath Courtney Love's dress at the Grammys.